So good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'd like to share this morning a fascicle from the Eihei Kuroku, which is Dogen's extensive record, Zen Master Dogen, who was the 13th century monk who founded the Soto Zen school of Buddhism, the school that we, the lineage that we practice with. This is a favorite fascicle of mine. I've probably talked about it at least a couple of times in the last 15 years or so. So if you've been around a while, you might have heard it before, but that's okay. So this is fascicle 111. Dogen recited Sokai's death verse. In 27 years, my ancient debt is not repaid. Leaping over the empty sky, I shoot myself into hell like an arrow. After reciting this, the teacher, Dogen, said, "Last night, Sokai, Sangha Ocean, dried up. How profusely the cloud and water monks have been crying. Although I see you, Sokai, right down to the ocean bottom, tears fill my breast like an overflowing lake. Yesterday, I held up and shook the whisk for your spirit. With this one word upon your departure, I don't wait for you to revive." So the story of Sokai, who was a Dharma heir of Dogen, a student of Dogen, he was 27 years old when he died. So of course it's sad when anyone dies. It's sad. But when someone who's more like a child or like at the beginning of their life, someone young dies, it's especially difficult. So this name Sokai, as I said, means Sangha Ocean. So my guess is with a name like that, that this student was loved by all. It was probably had a name like Sangha Ocean. Sangha means community. So if you have a name like Sangha Ocean, that's that says something. So what is Dogen's response? So this is maybe what we can learn about how to be with difficult emotions or to be with difficulties. So he says a lot of things, but then toward the end he says, "Although I see you right down to the ocean bottom," which to me is a way of saying, you're just completely one with everything. I still see you right down to the bottom. Everything is really complete and perfect. I'm seeing you. He says, "Although I see you right down to the ocean bottom, tears fill my breast like an overflowing lake." So these two were very close, and this loss affected Dogen profoundly. And I see their closeness also when I read Dogen's death verse. So Dogen died 12 years later at age 54. He was also kind of young, but for the time, 54 was okay. The lifespans weren't as long, except some of those Zen teachers lived really long. Anyway, Dogen, so Sokai's death verse, this is the verse that, you know, it's a tradition in Buddhist practice to, you know, as you're dying or just before death, you have a verse that expresses your truth, what your understanding, so your sort of last teaching that you want to express. And Sokai's death verse was this: "In 27 years, my ancient debt is not repaid. Leaping over the empty sky, I shoot myself into hell like an arrow." So it might seem a little funny, like, why is he shooting himself into hell? But we have, for example, Jizo Bodhisattva in the back, the standing statue. And one of the ideas of Jizo Bodhisattva, well, really all the bodhisattvas, is that they're willing to go into hell to save beings. So when he says, I shoot myself into hell like an arrow, he's saying, I'm willing to die, and then whatever happens, that I can help beings. If there's another life, if there's something, if there's a hell, I'm going to go there because that's where beings are suffering the most. So I'm going to just go straight there like an arrow. So that's Sokai's death verse. And then 12 years later, Dogen's death verse is 54 years lighting up the sky. A quivering leap smashes a billion worlds. Ha! Entire body looks for nothing. Living, I plunge into yellow springs. Yellow springs is another word for hell. So basically, it's like he's saying the same thing. So again, I really like this this fascicle because it shows to me Dogen's very human side. And also he's demonstrating to us what an enlightened person can look like or what an enlightened thought can look like. I think he's saying being enlightened doesn't mean having no feelings. It means completely having feelings, but also not clinging to them and not getting stuck. And of course, we all get stuck. And so that's our practice. Our practice is getting stuck and then getting stuck, getting unstuck, getting stuck, getting unstuck, over and over again. We focus on the breath in meditation, maybe. And then we notice our focus has wandered off from the breath and we're stuck somewhere else, and then we come back. Or we get stuck in our thoughts, swirling around. Or we get stuck in our feelings. Or we get stuck in sensations. So our practice is dropping those, getting unstuck, returning to the breath, or returning to our focus. And then we might get really good at following the breath and being present with the breath, and we might get stuck there. So then we drop that and get unstuck from the breath and simply open to what is. So that's practice. And sometimes circumstances are such that it's really difficult to avoid getting stuck. So sometimes things happen, trauma happens, something really difficult happens in our life, or even in the life of others that resonates with us, and we're really stuck. So some of you may know the tragic story of Patachara, who was a woman who lived at the same time as the Buddha. And she lost her husband and her two babies while they were all traveling to reconnect with her estranged family. There was a big storm, and I won't go into all the horrible circumstances, but basically it was very horrible. And they died, her husband and her newborn baby and her, I think, two-year-old. So they had been traveling to try to reconnect with her estranged family, and then she gets back to her hometown, and she learns that the same storm had killed her entire family in a flood. So now first of all, she's just given birth, so there's that. And then she's lost her two babies and her husband, and now her parents and her brothers and sisters are all gone. And so she just completely gets stuck. She goes mad. And it said she wanders in circles, her clothes become ragged and then fall off, and she doesn't care. She's just, wandering around, babbling incoherently, and people are afraid of her, and they chase her away with sticks. I mean, she's inconsolable and difficult to be around, so people don't like to be around her. But somehow she finds her way to the Buddha. And the Buddha meets her right where she is. So he doesn't try to change her. But at the same time, he sees deeply into her true expression. And he just says to her, "Sister, recover your presence of mind." But he doesn't say it in a way like, "Recover your presence of mind because you're really bugging me. You know, I'm really uncomfortable with how you are right now, so you better just recover your..." I mean, haven't we felt that way sometimes when we're with someone who's suffering deeply? Like, we just don't want to be there with it. And we don't want them to suffer, but there's also a part, it's like, I don't want to suffer with this. But I don't think that was the Buddha's... that was how he was encountering her. I think he was really encountering her with just complete acceptance of where she was at. But then he says, "Sister, recover your presence of mind." And because he says that from a very loving place without wanting her to change, she is actually able to recover her presence of mind in that moment. So she does. And then she tells him her story, which of course telling our stories is also part of transforming. Then we're connecting with what is. So she tells the story of what happened to her husband, her babies, her family. And then she says to the Buddha, "Help me." But the Buddha says to her, "Patachara, don't think you have come to someone who can help you. In your many lives, you have shed more tears for the dead than there is water in the four oceans." So in other words, he's telling her, you already know how to do grief. And your grief is your own. I can't actually help you with it. So what we can take from this is that our feelings, our thoughts, our sensations, our addictions, our habits, our mind games, all of that is all our own. And no one can really help us let go of these things. We have to go through them and let go on our own. So Patachara does this eventually, not immediately, but she joins the Sangha and she practices, and eventually she attains enlightenment. And it's said that she became a skillful, revered, and charismatic teacher. Well, you can kind of imagine someone who's suffered that much. If they are able to transform that suffering, what might happen? Susan Murcutt, who wrote a book about Buddhist women teachers of old, refers to her as an extraordinary woman, one of the most powerful personalities in the early Buddhist community. And she had a tremendous influence on other nuns. Poets of the Theragata, which is a collection of 73 poems in the canon of the early Buddhist literature. In the Theragata, she's referred to in poetry more often than any other woman. So with some of the things that have been in the news this week, people, especially women, but other people maybe who have suffered from sexual abuse and trauma are being re-traumatized, just re-triggered, just by hearing these stories. So that's part of why I thought of this. And bringing up this story, Dogen's story of Sokai's death and Patachara's story about how she dealt with so many deaths, is a way of reminding us that avoiding our grief or any other feelings or thoughts or sensations is not the Buddha way. And being enlightened does not mean being numb. And actually, when Patachara went mad with grief, I think what was happening is she was avoiding truly feeling her grief. So when you go mad with grief, it's like, no, this cannot be happening. So I'm going to create this wall of madness so that I actually don't take in, because it seems like it's too painful, so I'm going to keep it away. And of course, that's sometimes what we have to do, sometimes because of who we are and where we're at. That it's, even though it, we, you could say it's not really the best, that's what we have to do, so then we do that. But if we want to really practice, then we could invite ourselves, what needs to happen for that wall to crumble? What needs to happen for me to really receive my life and my experiences? So when Patachara actually receives, so telling her story is part of it, that's a part of the turning, telling her story, asking for help, hearing that, oh, you can't get help from outside. I mean, of course you can get help from outside. You can get support from your friends, from the Sangha, from reading about the teachings, but that's not exactly, you know, in the end, you still have to do it yourself. So when she realized that and started a process of practicing and bit by bit doing it, then she could actually feel it and let it flow through her and let it pass. And in Dogen's Dharma sharing, he also demonstrates a complete opening to his feelings and gives us a hint about how we might do that, because he says, although I see you down to the ocean bottom. So that's the hint that says, before we can maybe really feel and allow in the feelings, we have to create this huge container all the way to the ocean bottom, and we could say all the way up into space, and this big view. So that's the view of complete oneness and connection, and everything is perfect. That's this big view. And then within this big view, now there's this, oh, there's this sharp thing that happened. There's my personal story that happened that's really painful. But now that I have this big container, it's not creating the big container so that I can ignore the particular, but creating the big, or opening to the big container so that I can actually receive it. And then receiving it and letting the tears flow. He says, tears overflow, tears fill my breast like an overflowing lake. Then he says, yesterday I held up and shook the whisk for your spirit. So that's a reference to a ceremony that's performed at death to help whatever remains of consciousness to let go. So there's a shaking of this whisk. I don't have a whisk with me, but it's a big, like, horsehair whisk. Originally it was like a fly whisk to, like, you know, get the bugs, keep the bugs away, but then it became a ceremonial thing. So, and it would make a little noise, because the horsehairs would kind of shake together. But there's also snapping the fingers, or making some kind of sound, like to say, "It's you're done. Now you can go to the deceased." I remember when after my mother died, and we did some rituals around preparing her body, and then the people from the cremation society came, and they were, you know, wrapped her and they put her in the body bag. And then when they closed it up, there were these big buckles and it went click, click, click. And I thought, oh, that's good, because I hadn't done the snapping the fingers or anything. But then there was this, and it had a real sound of finality. So it's like, okay, that's good. Because now that her body's being taken away, it's good that she knows that she's dead. So I was grateful for that. So anyway, that's this no clinging to the body, like helping the person let go. And then also there's no clinging, you know, Dogen invites himself to do no clinging. He says, with this one word upon your departure, I don't wait for you to revive. So he cries and he grieves, and then he shakes the whisk makes that sound and says, okay, there's no if only. It's done. But what is this one word? He says, let's see, where is it now? Yesterday I held up and shook the whisk for your spirit with this one word upon your departure. I don't wait for you to revive. So what is this one word? He seems to be referring to shaking of the whisk, but that's not a word. That's an action. So I think there's something in which he says he's trying to and perhaps succeeding in expressing the inexpressible. One word. He seems to be demonstrating how to completely feel grief and let go of grief. And I found myself, especially when I first read this, you know, like 20 years ago, it's like I really wanted to know, what is that one word? Like, this would be the magic solution. I found a poem that I think speaks to this by a modern poet named Melissa Cannon. And this is a poem called Cry. There are no words for this, and never were. I should stop searching. I should stop asking the holes for their names. I should stop prying into the clogged mouths of corpses, their grins turn tongueless and fall. This is why the old babble and mutter, senility, telling us nothing. I should stop asking absence for its opinion. I should stop pressing my mouth between the mute thighs of women, hoping to suck out some secret. My mouth moves blindly among the dark places. In the delivery room, when the hole opened, I wanted to grab up the child quick, crush my ear to her mouth, capture its first wisdom. It was only a long cry smeared with blood. So Dogen says, there is one word. And this poet says, there are no words. But I kind of wonder, why does the poet want to stop searching? I think sometimes we want to stop searching because we are searching to try to get something. And that becomes exhausting. So I think that's what she's referring to. I want to stop searching in this way where I'm trying to get something so desperately, where I'm wanting to grab wisdom, even if it means crushing my ear to a baby's mouth. So when we search in that way, wisdom eludes us. When I was trying to find that, thinking finding that one word was going to unlock the secrets, wisdom eluded me. And then when wisdom is eluding us, that long cry smeared with blood is seen as an only. It's only a long cry smeared with blood. It's seen as not sufficient. But it might be the one word that expresses all. So I'd like to invite you, invite us, to stop searching in a goal-grabbing kind of way, to give up on that. But also invite you and myself to start searching with passion in a way that's open and curious. So, of course, we can search in this way by doing Zazen. And the practice instruction for this week is to notice what leads to well-being and happiness. Notice when we have well-being and happiness, and then notice, well, what led to that? That's a kind of searching. You can also search by expressing yourself and exploring what is your one word. And if you find one word, don't think that this one word will be the same word in the next moment. Well, that's my Dharma sharing for this morning. We have about 5 minutes or so before we need to close to start the ceremony, so I would welcome your questions or reflections. Thank you. Yes.
So the one word for me is catharsis.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my grief during my divorce. I'm under the dining room table howling my pain.
Mm.
Howling.
Mm.
My children watching me. And after that catharsis, I was fine.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, it's very timely what you're saying, because I was in an experience yesterday where I felt like somebody was sharing a re-triggering, especially after this week. And I just felt like I was like, this the lady is a Saturday. But it said my whole day, and I felt like it's not like I need to be there for everybody in this, but for some reason it's place where I do feel like people really need each other right now. But yeah, I don't know. I think if I didn't put up such big walls, it would probably go a little bit easier.
But really also remembering that to be there for ourselves and for others is what can we do to expand the container in which we can receive our lives. So that's why I encourage Zazen in our tradition. That is what we teach. Doing meditation practice is one way. It's not the only way, but it is one important way that we can actively do something about how can we train ourselves to expand our view. Because otherwise, we get stuck. And then we're not really able to help others or ourselves. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Can you say something else about some words that stuck with me that you said was in Dogen's story, you referred to getting past if only. There's no if only.
Uh-huh.
If only is a big part of grief.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's bargaining.
It's regret.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any ideas or suggestions on how do you get past that barrier in your grief?
Well, first would be not to see it as a barrier. So to even receive that part. So if you're in a if only, if you're in that kind of bargaining, wanting to, try to figure out how to fix it, then realize right there is that is your experience, and then receive that. What does that feel like? What does it feel like to be doing a if only? And then again, it's the same as the rest of the instruction, like how can I expand the container to receive that? We have time for one more, and then we have to stop. So Anne.
Maybe this is different for every person, but grief, if you let it run through you, I guess, genetically maybe, I have a tendency towards it.
Mm-hmm.
So to feel grief, it seems like sometimes it's, when do you know when it's skillful means to like allow yourself to be moved or by the world, and when is it a second arrow, like somehow not again, we're going to cycle through grief. Like, it could be hard to know sometimes.
Yeah, it could be really hard to know.
Really hard.
I think that if it comes up, then receiving it. But then there is sort of a skillful attention to if you see that it's taking you down and down so that you don't have the wide view anymore,
right.
Then you have to say, something else has to happen. So sometimes in that situation, you might say, I need to go over here and watch a funny movie.
Right.
or I need to go for a, you know, walk and look at the, you know, the sunset, or I need to go downhill skiing, or, you know, I need to do something to kind of make a shift so that I can open to a wider view and then receive it. Because actually where it's spiraling down and where it's not again, then it's being stuck.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, everyone.